Hi folks, it's your host Harmit, and you're listening to Tobin Talks.
So, the grand opening of the concert hall is on September 5th. I'll ask the obvious question first, as someone who is relatively new to the university. Where did the Faculty of Music hold its concerts before this new concert hall?
Multiple different places in the city and on campus. So, on campus, we have some of the rehearsal spaces in Taché, Eva Claire Hall on 65 Defoe Road, which is where the old Faculty of Music used to be. Sometimes we've held them at St. John's College as well. And in the community, various churches, Jubilee Place, the theater at Molière Theater on Provence and Des Mirons. We've held concerts there. So various spaces within the community, Gas Town Theater is another place. Yeah.
Nice, yeah. Now, what factors necessitated the construction of this venue, and what advantages does it have over the old a slew of venues?
Well, there's been no bona fide concert hall attached to, well, like a true performance space that would hold. There is a concert hall, a recital hall at 65 Defoe Road, but the stage is very small, and it could accommodate a piano and a singer, or perhaps a string quartet, but anything above five musicians, it gets very, very complicated. The stage here can accommodate a full orchestra and choir, so it's like a true concert hall. State-of-the-art acoustics. It has availability, can accommodate. One thing we'll be having this fall will be an opera, which will have all the singers on stage, but like a true opera, there will be an orchestra that will be accompanying it, but it will be in an orchestra pit as well. So there's a pit that can accommodate opera and musical theater.
Nice. So how many students are in the faculty? About 200? What benefits can they expect to see out of the new facility? You mentioned the new, like the improved acoustics and the size of the stage and the seating area.
But the seating area, that would be, instead of performing in a rehearsal space, actually performing on a real state-of-the-art concert hall venue itself. We have a new piano that will be available for performance. The piano is a 9-foot CFX model from Yamaha. It's a real amazing piano. So the ability to perform on a concert grand on a state-of-the-art acoustic space is really sort of it provides probably the closest analog a student's going to have to real-world performance.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that as part of their performance experience here.
Yeah, definitely. Like when I was younger, I used to play piano, and it was definitely always a special experience to actually be able to play on a grand piano
But to play on a grand
synthesizers
piano,
and
real
keyboards.
Amazing. With this piano, mm-hmm. whether you're a singer, musician of any kind, to be part of an orchestra and to not be playing in a school gym or nothing against Jubilee Place, but it's not really going to have the same, it doesn't have the same acoustic as what I know will be in this space here. It's been specifically, the architectural design was right from the very beginning designed to have an acoustic space specific for music.
Yeah, nice. And so I assume that as the dean, you'll be attending the grand opening.
Yes.
Are there any performances you are particularly excited for?
Well, just to tell you about the concert itself. So mm-hmm. the first half will have three sort of mini performances, about 10, 15 minutes each. So it'll be two operatic singers with accompanied by piano. There'll be a traditional piano trio, so piano, violin, and cello, our resident piano trio. Then we'll have a jazz quintet.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be performing. It'll be a break, and then William Prince will be in the second half. So I'm looking forward to it all.
Yeah,
actually, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll be a variety of different musical experiences,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
But one of the exciting things about this hall is not just for what it will be for the students and the university, but for the Winnipeg community, because there is no true state-of-the-art concert hall in the south part of the city. All mm-hmm. the music making takes place in the exchange areas, the
yeah.
concert hall. As I mentioned earlier, Jubilee Place, there are a couple of schools, school theaters in the north end, but there's nothing on the south side. To have a real bona fide hall is going to dramatically change how the dynamic of mm-hmm. music making in the city. There'll be a lot more attention towards the university in terms of it being a venue that can have real high level quality performances taking place. Mm-hmm. You don't have to just think about the concert hall. The size of the hall is 409 seats, so it's a perfect size for that kind of mid-size audience expectation, mm-hmm. Audience attendance
yeah.
for a hall, for a concert, I should say. Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, it's not quite like Burton Cummings size, but it's certainly bigger than Park Theater, for example.
Absolutely, exactly. Mm-hmm. But the acoustics are far beyond Burton Cummings Theater or mm-hmm. any of these schools that
yeah.
you find. Yeah, it's really quite special. And I know that there's been professional, semi-professional groups that are booking or have booked. Well, I can say one, Manitoba Chamber Orchestra will be performing here on the 25th of October.
Mm-hmm.
25th of September, I should say. Jazz Winnipeg with Thompson Highway will be performing here on October 19th. Dead of Winter with Andrew Belfour will be here on the 20th. Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra will be doing one or two concerts in the new year here. I know a number of dance groups in the city are interested in using the space as well.
Yeah.
So it isn't just music. It could be musical theater, it could be dance, mm-hmm. a whole raft of different things. But all in the south part of the city, it's very exciting mm-hmm. actually, because it's yeah. never happened before.
Yeah, that sound very exciting. And I'm sure there will be potentially more walk-ups, I guess, from university students now that there is something on
for sure
on campus.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. So could you please tell me why you chose to go into your line of research?
Sure, yeah. Maybe could I just clarify just off the top, just because mm-hmm. we haven't spoken directly. My understanding is you're wanting to talk primarily about wildfires and extreme heat, climate
yes.
connections, and it's for the paper.
Yes.
The student newspaper, is that right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds good. So why I chose this line of work? Interesting question. I would say definitely a lifelong interest in environmental issues. And my previous job before working for the Canadian Climate Institute, I worked as a consultant for a while, working in particular with environmental organizations and some government ministries in BC, working on natural resource issues and in particular and some climate related issues. And before that, I worked for the BC Greens as their director of policy in the BC legislature. And I worked on a variety of issues, but definitely was particularly passionate about climate related issues and natural resource management related issues. So it's a natural fit to go from that type of work into more of a focus specifically on climate, and then in particular on adaptation, which is really interesting to me because, you know, alongside the need to reduce emissions, there's a lot that we can do here in the Canadian context to protect ourselves and to protect communities, alongside the need to really be ambitious about transitioning our economy. So that's a great field to work in because there's a lot that communities and that governments can do to protect people from the worst impacts of climate change, even as we try to reduce the root causes of emissions.
Interesting. Okay, so could you please tell me about climate change, heat waves, and wildfires?
Yeah, for sure. So I can talk a little bit about the different aspects and then let me know if you're interested in diving into anything in more detail. So
Sounds good.
there's a well-established connection in the scientific literature between worsening climate change, worsening extreme heat and heat waves, and worsening wildfires. So there's a number of pathways through which this happens. But in particular, so climate change affects both and affects them independently. So climate change obviously results in higher temperatures as well as longer heat waves. So it results in heat waves lasting longer, and it also results in higher peak temperatures. And we know that those peak temperatures can be extremely dangerous and very deadly, and I'd be happy to talk about that more. Climate change also dries out the landscape, so it dries out vegetation and soil. And it increases temperatures, as I mentioned, and results in more erratic rainfall patterns. So these conditions come together to make the forest much more vulnerable, whatever the cause of a wildfire is. It makes it much more likely that when a wildfire is ignited, that it spreads more quickly and can become more out of control. And then climate change has also been shown to increase the incidence of thunderstorms and lightning strikes. And that trigger of lightning is a really common trigger. It triggers most wildfires in Canada. And in 2023, lightning was the cause of the 93% of the area burned was caused by lightning strikes. So that's a important trigger. But it's essential to acknowledge that whatever the trigger, the fact that climate change worsens these conditions overall, dries out the landscape, has higher temperatures, more erratic rainfall means that wildfires, whatever the cause, are more likely to be worse.
Okay, awesome. Is there any interesting research or information that you feel may be interesting to highlight in the article?
For sure, you've been on this connection specifically
Yes.
between climate change. Yeah, we put out a fact sheet summarizing some relevant research. I'm not sure if you've seen that. I'm happy to send you some of the links in
Okay.
that sheet
Sounds good.
that point to some of the academic articles that I'm talking about. Environment and Climate Change Canada has also started a rapid weather attribution program that you may be familiar with, and has found that climate change has made wildfires. Let me make sure I get the number right here. So on heat waves and on wildfires, so their recent attribution service found that the 2024 June heat wave that struck East Central and Eastern Canada was 2 to 10 times more likely because of climate change. And temperatures in Quebec and Atlantic Canada were over 10 degrees higher than normal during that heat wave. So that's an interesting new tool that the government has put out to try to rapidly show how much more likely some of these extreme events are because of climate change.
For sure. Okay, well, thanks for sharing that. So I
Yeah.
guess the final question I had is there any message that you want to convey to students?
Yeah, I would say on extreme heat in particular, I think one thing that I think is quite important, and I think it's starting to shift in terms of how we talk about heat, but we're still a little bit behind the severity of the issue, is that just the severity of the health impacts of extreme heat, as well as the health impacts of the air quality in particular coming out of worsening wildfire seasons. Just to say that extreme heat in particular is Canada's deadliest natural disaster or climate fuel disaster. And the 2021 heat dome in BC, 619 people lost their lives. And primarily people who are older, people with underlying health conditions. And a recent study found that socioeconomic status, so income, was a primary determinant of how likely you were to die or have negative health outcomes from the heat dome. So I think that's just a really important piece to drive home to everybody, just how serious the consequences of extreme heat are and how climate change is really an important driver in that. I think people understand the severity and the devastation of wildfires, but extreme heat can also be devastating just in a sort of less public way sometimes.
So the first question I had is, why did you choose to go into your line of research?
So yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity. So I will speak for myself. So I'm trained. I have interdisciplinary training in social work, public health, and psychology. So for quite some times, we knew that health and social disparities very disproportionately affect Canada's marginalized and equity-seeking communities. And so to address this injustice, we at the Village Lab, we created the Village Lab, which is a community-based health research lab at the University of Manitoba. We're really committed as an entity to improving access to healthcare, to social services for a variety of marginalized, disenfranchised, equity-seeking communities. So our work is at the confluence of social work, public health, psychology, social sciences, and what we do at the core at the Village Lab is really look at the relationship between injustice, socioeconomic injustice, and different types of health outcomes and health disparities. So we look at the relationship between equity, marginalization, injustice, and how it affects people's health, different diverse communities in health. So kind of my work primarily examines that and examines how oppression affects the health and well-being of marginalized and equity-seeking communities, with the idea to develop more culturally sensitive healthcare and more culturally safe community service models. So that's kind of what kind of motivated me and kind of my training, my work that kind of led me here. I don't know if Melissa, you want to kind of speak about yourself from your vantage point.
Sure. So I'm Melissa Morris. I am the Village Lab manager, and I'm also a Bachelor of Social Work student in the Faculty of Social Work. My pronouns are she, they. I got involved with the Village Lab. I'm also a person with lived experience, and I have the opportunity to come on as a community research associate. And really, what I was interested in doing was hearing the voices of the community. So really, getting to hear the voices of, and I don't really like using the terms marginalized, even though those are the terms. But just really hearing the voices, I think Village Lab does a very good job of centering the community in all the work that we do. And it's also been very anti-oppressive in bringing on people with lived experience, helping build capacity and putting them in leadership roles.
I would just add also to this. So thanks, Melissa, for reminding me. Like we the whole idea of what we do is to work with communities, to empower communities. So Village Lab was born in 2021. Kind of it was founded as this interdisciplinary community-based health research lab housed at the Faculty of Social Work. So we aim to facilitate and support high-quality community-led research through strong community collaborations and relationship. And we draw on a variety of community-based research models, approaches, decolonizing methodologies, indigenous methodologies, and we operate at the intersection of health and social sciences. So kind of what we do and our mission is to become a leader and catalyst in Manitoba for improving the health and well-being of key and priority populations. So a lot of our work is in HIV research, sexually transmitted and blood-borne infections research, sexual health, mental health, infectious disease, drug use, harm reduction. And so we do research, we do education, interventions, work with policymakers. So we're really kind of that catalyst for those type of research kind of that we do. And so in our structure of the Village Lab, I work as a director. Melissa is a manager, but we're also guided by an Indigenous elder, a knowledge holder. If you look at our website, villagelab.ca, you'll find quite a lot of more information about our team under the team subsection of the of our website. We're guided by an Indigenous elder, Albert MacLeod, who is a two-spirit Indigenous elder in the community who guides our work to make sure our work is relevant to diverse communities involved. We have many graduate, undergraduate students working with us as research assistants, community members. We bring different organizations and communities. So we try to kind of partner with communities outside of university environments. University environments can be very privileged environments, right? So it's like a almost like an ivory tower. So we really make sure the voices of community members, particularly those living with HIV, navigating addictions, living in poverty, and other kind of facing other oppressions, can really work with us on issues that affect their communities. And we have multiple big projects. I will talk about some, and Melissa will talk about some other ones. So we have many active projects. Once again, if you go to the villagelab.ca, you can look at the research in the research tab, all the different projects that we currently have undertaken. Most of them, on key and priority populations. That's the term that we use, key and priority populations in HIV and harm reduction. So that includes Indigenous communities, First Nations, Métis, Inuit people. And we do a variety of projects with those communities. Black, African, and Caribbean communities is another key and priority populations. 2S LGBTQIA communities, so two-spirit, queer, trans communities, we do quite a lot of research. Refugees and migrants, people who use drugs, people who live with HIV and hepatitis C, so a variety of communities. And we do different projects on HIV testing, looking at if care is accessible and safe for communities, how we can improve care and treatment for people living with HIV, different barriers that communities face. We want to make sure that the care we have in Manitoba and in the prairies is accessible for communities. And how do we do it? We study different barriers and facilitators to care at the Village Lab. So maybe, Melissa, you could talk a little bit about some of the seminal projects involving Indigenous communities that we have that could be highlighted, like Gigi Bapaman.
Yeah, so the Gigi Bapaman project was looking at the health and well-being of Indigenous people living with HIV during the COVID pandemic. There was a few key themes that came out of that, one of them was that access to services was really a barrier during the pandemic for these people. A second theme that emerged was the resilience and coping mechanisms that these people used just to get through. Surviving through intersecting pandemics. And a lot of that was culturally based. People, you turn to a lot of Indigenous ceremonies to just get by. And we also learned that there was an increased amount of drug use and disparities among Indigenous people living with HIV during the pandemic. It was a really interesting study. We got to hear a lot of different voices from the community across both provinces. And people really, really just were grateful for having their story heard. And we think it's an important study to just help address the needs, especially if another intersecting pandemic occurs, how do we prepare ourselves properly and make sure that everyone has equitable access to services? So it was led by our elder, Albert MacLeod. He gifted us the name Gigi Bapaman, which means we survived, and it was given to us by the Ojibwe language specialist, Roger Roulette, who has since passed. And Albert continues his work on the Anishinaabe life model that Roger created and that we based our project off of. So we used Indigenous methodology to really just connect us to the population that this project was looking into.
So that's the Gigi Bapaman project. We also have a research study called Ubuntu Pamoja Study, which is a project that looks at HIV testing, Black, African, Caribbean communities. And in that project, we're trying to understand how to improve access to HIV testing for Black, African, Caribbean communities, how to address anti-Black racism in healthcare. Another project that we had in the lab was called Manitoba Two-Spirit Gay by Queer Men's Health Study. That project looked at how to improve HIV services for this community and how to address homophobia and transphobia in healthcare services to improve access for communities. Our project, another project called the Migration and Health Study, looked at the creation of migrant-affirming care in Manitoba. What does it mean to have services that are affirming of the different migrant identities and the struggles that refugee communities are facing, how we can make sure that the care is accessible for those communities and the services are provided in the languages spoken by different migrants in Manitoba. So that's kind of what's at the core of our work. We also offer a lot of capacity strengthening to communities. So people living with HIV, our students living with HIV, navigating other oppressions, we employ them, we give them jobs in the labs, right? So they can put this on their CV and it helps their careers to move forward. We do the same thing for community members. We really bring them into our research. We hire them as community research associates. And so they get trained, right? They get trained, they learn things so that they can do good things for their own community. So that's kind of our model. We do a lot of capacity strengthening, is what we call capacity building and capacity strengthening in communities.
I guess the next question I had is, what is your ultimate goal at the lab?
Our vision, what we are as a lab, is to envision a future in which socially and economically disenfranchised communities, equity-seeking communities, including key and priority populations, people living with HIV or affected by those health inequities, a future where those people enjoy a life of optimal health, well-being, and meaningful social inclusion. So that's kind of what is we're seeing. At the core, Village Lab holds different values. We are guided by social justice-oriented and human rights agenda and a strong commitment to decolonization, equity, and diversity and inclusion.
So the final question I had is there any message that you want to convey to the university community?
I think that it's important for everyone at the university to educate them themselves more on the issues that our communities face, and especially within social work, just to make sure that people are receiving that equitable care.
What we really, the message that we want to send is we need to be more supportive of equity seeking and marginalized communities. We continue outlining and identifying different oppressions that affect those communities. And so we need to have support from policymakers, from advocates in the community to continue this work that we're doing. All that we're doing is for communities. We want to see healthy communities, strong communities. As a matter of fact, if you look at our kind of the slogan for the Village Lab, it says research for stronger communities. So we really want kind of to improve the health and well-being of communities. And we do it by really attending to the social determinants of health, to the structural oppressions that communities face.
We encourage the University of Manitoba community to follow us on our social media pages. So we do have an Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook page where people can find out more information about our new publications and what's going on in our lab.
We have different recommendations for service providers and the larger community beyond university. We want to make sure that the voices of communities who participated in our research are heard. And so we encourage people to have a stronger uptake of our research. And I really hope this thing that you published about us, like, will allow more people to learn who we are and what we do. So there's a kind of a bigger uptake of our work. And I really appreciate what you're doing here.
Well, folks, that's everything for today's Tobin Talks episode. If you have any questions, concerns, or suggestions, please feel free to email me at audio@themanitoban.com. You can listen to Tobin Talks anytime on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, you name it, and you can pick up a copy of The Manitoban from stands all throughout campus.
Tune in on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. to be the first to hear new Tobin Talks episodes.
Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you then.